accession number 18614, real 4.
Jack Holness, real 4.
Stayed overnight at second echelon and got everything prepared for the next day to move when it was dark into the battalion position. These boys of the Works and Wiltshire Yeomanry were speaking to us during the day and hanging around the area. They could hear the action going on a few miles away. They said, "Where's the front?" We told them where the front was. They wanted to know all about it. They were what we call white kneed. We were a bit browner. We used to use the expression, "Get your knees brown" in the desert. We knew they'd just come up. But they were good lads. And like I had been, they were apprehensive of what was to follow. Volunteers among those lads were asked to drive we lads from the battalion and these guns up into the battalion position during the hours of darkness. This we did. I arrived with my gun at my section position, where during the day the gun pit, which had been for the 25 pounder, had been widened. They'd been forewarned to widen it so that it could take the 6 pounder anti-tank gun. I arrived with this 6 pounder, and in the early hours of the following morning, it must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, we manhandled the 6 pounder into position, having taken the 2 pounder out, hitched that up to the back of this vehicle. Off the lads went from the Works and Wilts, towing this 2 pounder out of the way, and we had established, my section sergeant was full of questions for me. Obviously, we'd had no training. I had had no training. I'd seen it. I'd learned about the breech block, what happened with it, how to load it, etc., etc. But section sergeant said to me, "Have you fired it?" I said, "No, not with the 6 pound shell. I've fired it sub caliber." And he said, "Do you know how it works?" I said, "Yes, I know how it works." I said, "But it's not like the 2 pounder, because you could sit on the 2 pounder in a seat and observe every shot you made, because it was telescopic sights, cushioned, and you could ride with the recoil of the 2 pounder and observe the shot. With a 6 pounder, it would have taken a man's head off if it stayed there. So when once you'd got on the target, you just had to say on and move your head aside, because the recoil on the 6 pounder anti-tank gun was terrific compared with the 2 pounder. He said, the section sergeant, Sergeant Stacey, said to me, "Can you lay this gun on the trouble spots we had every morning? An Italian tank would come round the edge of an escarpment about 1,000 yards away, and he was the observation post for the German guns which were being brought to bear on the box. We couldn't touch him with a 2 pounder, he knew that, and we could see him standing up in his turret 1,000 yards away, observing us and giving directions to the German gunners. And my section sergeant said, "Lay it on there as stand to came in the morning," which we always stood to at the first signs of dawn, which was about 4:30 in the morning, 5 o'clock, and I laid this as near as I could on as light came on the edge of this escarpment. I said, "Well, I don't suppose we can hit him with the first shot, because these guns need bedding. The recoil is such, and they have two great big spade legs, and they need to dig in to settle the gun itself. We laid it on the edge of the escarpment that morning. Sure enough, he was there giving directions to the German gunners. My section sergeant said, "Can you lay it on?" I sighted it about 900 to 1,000 yards, pinpointed in the cross sights, which were telescopic sights, of course, got him in the sights. They put one up the breech, pushed it in, loaded, on, I gave on, turned away, fire. And the action of firing, whereas with the 2-pounder, I actually did the firing with the foot pedal, or if it jammed, there was an alternative hand firing point. In this case, the sergeant actually hit the firing pin. It was on the side of the breech block. I'd given on, moved away, fire. He hit it, and the sighting shot, as you call the first shot with an anti-tank gun, hit him fair and square. I've never seen, an awful thing to say maybe, because men were killed. Italians, maybe. Still men, but our lads in the section cheered. We had at last something to hit back with, and that was at almost 1,000 yards. It was possible to damage at 1,200 yards with a 6-pounder anti-tank gun, but this was about 1,000 yards, and it ripped him apart with the first, which we would have thought was a sighting shot. If he'd got a sighting shot at him, he would have got out of the way. But luckily, it got him. And from then on, the lads all knew that we had something we could use against a Tiger tank, which from then on, we were in action with the 6-pounders. And we had to learn very quickly. As I say, we'd had no training on them. And the battle went on for, we were surrounded on three sides so often by German tanks. Our few tanks went out and did battle with them. The few we had from outside the box. I forget, I think they were the Queen's Royal Hussars who were manning those tanks. There were no real match for the Germans at the time. And things got so very, very hot in the box. It's well known in the annals of the Western Desert actions that the Knightsbridge box, it got its name as the cauldron because never had so much shelling and Stuka dive bombing occurred anywhere in the Western Desert before that time. It was day after day after day. During that time, we were told on two or three separate occasions we were pulling out, we were to retreat, pulling out to pack what small kit we wanted, leave the rest, and then orders superseded, we're staying where we are. We stayed there for a total of 17 days in that defensive position. Most of the time surrounded, fighting off as we could, but we held. And it would be the day of...
Did any incidents happen during those 17 days to you that you ought to recount?
I'm coming to that, yes. We were told on the 13th of June, and I will remember it, it was a Friday, the that we were going to evacuate the box that night under darkness. We were going to come out because we were more or less being overrun. But I don't know what time. We were under such heavy shell fire, we were not manning the gun. We were more or less pinned down into slit trenches. We had a dugout we'd made for protection from shrapnel. We had dug it well out so we could sit in it about 4 feet deep. And we'd covered over the top, we'd placed what we call mine pickets. Mine pickets are angle iron poles to support barbed wire. They've got a pointed end and a flat end, but they're angle iron, about 6 feet in length. And we'd placed some of these across this dugout, and we laid the armour plating sides, which were cumbersome pieces of armour plating about 3/8 to 1/2 inch thick, and we laid two of these across the dugout we'd made, and then we'd put sandbags around the outer edge and sandbags over the top to give us protection, leaving just a small hole to slide into when under the heaviest shelling. I was in there, I'm given to understand it was somewhere about lunchtime on that Friday, having been given the wares that were pulling out at darkness that night. I was in there with my section sergeant, Sergeant Stacey. Then I can only reiterate what I was told afterwards. A shell hit the dugout, albeit the top of the dugout. I came out of this blur of unconsciousness, and my senses naturally been totally dulled. I was buried. My section sergeant, who had been sitting on the left of me, was completely buried. I realised, apart from being trapped, I realised I had my left arm free from the elbow down, and I felt for his head. I found his hair and pulled, lifted. He was gasping, and I held his head above the sand, and I was trapped by, albeit the flat end of one of these mine pickets was holding me against the side of the dugout, I was supporting the whole weight of the armoured plating, which had smashed my arm. It smashed my arm, that come down on my arm, and I was buried. In my silly state of half consciousness, I thought I'd lost my legs because I was buried. These are thoughts that go through you. I then passed out again and came to again with a waft of clear air, and my pals in the section were trying to pull us out. I was holding on to Sergeant Stacey. He'd lost consciousness, and they pulled us out. The nearest place to put us in was a 6-inch mortar pit which was full of mortar bombs, and they carried us both into this pit. I thought, well, if one hits this, we've all gone. From there, eventually, a certain corporal, as I remember, he wasn't of our section, a Corporal Burke, he was a very cool customer, put a rifle on his shoulder, and off he went to the nearest point where he could get onto a field telephone and get the MO and the ambulance. Eventually, I was quite conscious by this time. They put us on stretchers, and the ambulance could only get so far towards us. He was on a high spot with the flag flying from the ambulance, the Red Cross, and with him was the battalion padre with the MO, the battalion padre, and I can even remember the names, Padre Lunt, and the MO was a Captain Eden of the Medical Corps. He got us into the ambulance. This Corporal Beck I mentioned earlier walked alongside of the stretcher bearers, taking us to the ambulance, heedless of everything that was going on around us, and we were being really heavily shelled. It was incessant. And he walked to the ambulance with us. Very brave lad, I considered, Corporal Beck. I never came across him again after that. We were taken to the regimental aid post, which was out in front of the battalion, a great big white tent with a great big red cross on it. This was the usual procedure for an RAP, we call them. Taken in there, as I said, my right arm was badly smashed up. I didn't know until they cleaned me off what was wrong. I'd got shrapnel in the neck, I'd got shrapnel in the back. Couldn't feel anything much. There was no real feeling, not what you can call a lot of pain. Was fixed up with a sling and dressings put on the shrapnel wounds. My section sergeant was still totally unconscious. They found that his only wound seemed to be slight shrapnel on the top of his head, but he was unconscious. He remained that way. I became walking wounded. I had my legs. They were okay. I'd recovered. And along with another chap from another company who'd been wounded in the leg, we, during the, I can only say what was the afternoon, and the shelling was going, obviously going over the RAP. It was very easy for enemy to see it. They had been given the instruction to pack up in the regimental aid post. So we couldn't be kept in there. I remember they seemed to be well off in the RAP because they were Royal Army Medical Corps, most of them. And they seemed to have quite a bit of food compared with what we had in the sections. They had some tin fruit. And I remember being given a bowl, a mess tin, of tinned fruit, peaches, I believe, nectar to the gods. We might as well eat all these up, they said, because we've got to pull out, we'll be leaving stuff. Now we've got to take you out to a safer place as we can put you. We were taken out and told to crawl under an ambulance which was dug in, which I earlier told you about the way we dug vehicles in, nose in to about 10 feet drop, and the tailboard sticking out the back to protect the engines. We were told to crawl under this vehicle. The padre came, this Bill Morris, they called this other chap from 3 Company, I was in number 2 Company, anti-tank company, and we were given a 50 tin of Egyptian cigarettes. Well, Egyptian cigarettes were really horrible. But we laid under there, under this vehicle, for hours and hours, until total darkness fell. We smoked every one of these 50 Egyptian cigarettes. The sand was just littered with the butt ends. And then it must have been somewhere in the region of 11 o'clock at night when we were extricated by medical orderlies from under this vehicle. And we were difficult to say because there was such chaos and things happening. Jerry, by this time, I don't think he'd got wind that we were pulling out, but there was tracer flying all over the place, and we walked, Bill Morris and I, we walked with these orderlies to an ambulance, being darkness and things lit up with the action that was going on. We walked to an ambulance, we were put into this ambulance. There were 4 stretchers in the ambulance, 2 at the top, 2 at the bottom. There were 3 of us walking wounded. There were 7 of us all together. I don't know who the others were. I was seated with my back to the cab. Bill was seated next to me. We were told then we were getting out through the gap in the minefield, and that the lads in the battalion were going to march out the infantry companies, rifle companies, and that my company, they would be attempting with what little transport we had, because most of the transport had been taken out of the box earlier in the battle for safety and had gone down to first echelon. So there was very little transport, so the lads, the majority of the lads, were going to march to a rendezvous, a predetermined position, we were told. I'll end all this later, at a place called Acroma. I went out in this ambulance, midnight, early hours of the morning. The ambulance was shot at. Whether or not it rumbled that we're on the way out, but I was travelled throughout the night, a rather bumpy ride, painful bumpy ride, and eventually arrived the next morning at, I think it was Sidi Barani, where there was a CCS, which was a concrete emplacement of a sort of aid post where there were stretchers laid for wounded, and it was tented over the top, dug in, concreted, and this was the next hospital area after your regimental aid posts. There were some nurses there, I remember, and they were front line, those girls. Make no bones about it, they were front line, those girls. And we were tended to as well as they could that night. The next morning, we were put in ambulances again and taken to Brook Hospital. Everything was chaotic. Vehicles were coming down, tanks, guns. Everything was on the retreat. I was taken to the hospital. There were hundreds of wounded men laid around on stretchers or walking wounded as I was, but I had in Tobruk, I found my section sergeant. I stayed by his side. He was still unconscious, and I stayed by his side as long as I could until they came. It was like a big aircraft hangar in Tobruk, and there were just certain areas screened off where they were attending to wounded. The doctors were, I remember, doctor who came for me, big man, stripped to the waist, just with an operating gown on, in Wellington boots, and an operating cap. I can see him now in rubber gloves, and I was taken through. The worst wounded naturally were taken first, and they did what they could for them, patching them up. I was patched up. All they did with me was slap a wet plaster, just plastered, put my arm into plaster, more or less, not an examination, just, and redressed the shrapnel wounds. And we got a bed for one night into Tobruk Hospital. The next morning, the whole hospital was being evacuated because Rommel's army was overrunning every area. I was put into an ambulance with three other chaps and three Tobruk nurses who were also being evacuated, the staff of the hospital. The hospital was being totally evacuated. Apparently, the day before, I just missed the last hospital ship to get out of Tobruk Harbour, the Landovery Castle it was called, and it was loaded with wounded and on its way down to South Africa. I missed it by 24 hours. I left Tobruk, the only road, coast road, down was strewn with tanks and vehicles. On the retreat, pulling back to what was later known as the Alamein line, the defensive line. Our ambulance driver was a volunteer American. We couldn't stay on the road because it was jam-packed with vehicles that were trying to get us down as quickly as possible. Were most of the time driving on the sand at the side of the road, very bumpy ride. We eventually arrived at a place called Mesamatru, where there was another CCS hospital, staffed once again by nurses and medical orderlies. We were taken there.